of time on what we didn't finish yesterday, and because I would like to devote the main topic of the class for what we, again, for the other side, which is the topic of this class, which is class number 3. However, as I said, I would start with what we didn't finish last time. I wrote on the board the 9 different chapters of the history of Jewish mysticism, although, as I said, the word mysticism is not a Hebrew word, and the two words that we should use is Sod and Kabbalah. Sod as mysticism, mystery, Kabbalah as tradition. I would read it aloud by the numbers. Number 1, Yehezkel, Ezekiel, that we talked about. Next to it, please put the name Sadok. Yehezkel is from the family of the high priest whose name is Sadok. He himself is a great proponent of the name Sadok. If you would take even at a glance from the last 8 chapters of Ezekiel 40-48, you would see that he is talking a great deal on the Kohanim name Sadok, as the only people who deserve to work and to serve in the Holy of Holies. Book number 2 is Qumran, those who call themselves a Kohanim name Sadok, that's their name, in the various documents that we found. And next to each book I put the chronological point of departure. Ezekiel is 597 to 587. He's in the 6th century before the Common Era. Bnei Sadok HaKohanim is the 2nd and 3rd century BCE and the 1st century CE. Number 3, Sefer Yetzirah, that we talked about last time. It was written somewhere, sometime, between the 1st century to the 7th century. As I said, there are many speculations, but there is not one conclusive evidence. I tend to the suggestion of Judah Libet that it is on the 1st century. However, as I said, there are many other opinions. We do know that it is an unicum, as I said, a unique book, and we would place it sometime in the early centuries of the Common Era. Number 4 is the Kutahei Chalot, again, that we talked yesterday about, and it is sometime 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th century. Now, since this is not a one book, but this is a variety, this is a library, we can safely say that some was written in the end of the 2nd century, some was written in the 3rd century, some in the 4th century, some in the 5th century. It's not one book, that's a whole genre. So, like we would say that the Mishnah and the Talmud are along the 1st century of the Common Era, the same we can say about Heichalot literature. The word Heichalot, as I said, is the plural of Sefer, and the 3 heroes of this literature are Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Ishmael, and Chanoch Matato. Okay? We are making a jump. It's nearly a jump of 1,000 years, or, 900, 800, but if the next stage that we are talking about historically is Reshita Kabbalah, the beginning of Kabbalah, and Sefer HaZohar, we are in the 12th and 13th century of the Common Era, which is definitely, however, we won't calculate it, it is many, many centuries after 3rd, 4th, 5th century. We are talking on nearly a millennium. For the question why there is no Jewish mysticism or anything that came down to us, from the Geonic period until the early Kabbalah, there is no answer that anyone can really offer with certainty. We just say, the only thing we can say for certainty is that nothing has come down to us. So if there were any writings, or if there was any kind of oral tradition, it did not come to us earlier than the 12th century. I don't say that there hasn't been. I say that it didn't come to us. We can talk only of what we know. As far as we know, there is nothing in the 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th, 7th century, so we have to leave it at that. What do we know about the beginning of Kabbalah? We know one thing for sure. It took place somewhere in Spain and France, in the circles of the yeshivot, in the circles of Baalei Torah, Baalei Midrash, Baalei Halacha. It was not marginal, nor was it controversial in any way. It was a spiritual arousal that took place within the halakhic families, within the leadership families of Spain and France. We know about the family of the Raizet, Rabbi Abraham ben David, the author of the Book of Eshkol. We know about his son, Rabbi Yitzchak Sazinaho, which means Rabbi Yitzchak the Blind. We know about his grandson, Rabbi Asher ben David. All of them are people who are part and parcel of the halakhic world, the halakhic leadership. They, within those circles that are exploring new spiritual avenues, the Kabbalah is around. We should say that the same people who are writing down Midrashim, the same people who are working on the halakhic, on the Tosafot, on the Baalei Tosafot, the same people who are doing the PUT, the Midrashim, who are transferring the tradition, are the very same people within which circles the Kabbalah is started to be written down. Now I want to make sure this point. We can talk only as far as written tradition is available for us. We don't take written traditions before the end of the 12th century and the 13th century. It doesn't mean that it wasn't a living power earlier. It might well have been, but we don't know anything about it. What we know chronologically and historically is that in the circles of the rabbinic leadership, the halakhic leadership, the midrashic, poetic, liturgic leadership, spiritual, new spiritual avenues are explored, and for them this is the same side of the same world. It is like a deepening into the halakhic world. It is a deepening into the spiritual heritage. It's exploring more possibilities of freedom of the same sacred text. The only new thing about it is that they are saying that they are now informing us about innovations which were transmitted through a Holy Spirit. They're using the coin Ruach HaKodesh, Hashem Chadsha Bebet Midrashenu. They don't tell us exactly how this Ruach HaKodesh came about and what it is, the legitimacy of it. They just say that's the way it is, those new things that we write about. Rabbi Yitzchak Sazinaho, Rabbi Asher ben David, Rabbi Abraham ben David. Those people are writing in a very encoded way, in a short way, points of reference of a new perception which we call early Kabbalah. When we look carefully, what is that they're talking about? What is in the text that came down to us? They're talking on the name of God, they're talking on the temple, they're talking on sacrifices, they're talking on Menorah HaMikdash. They are talking on things that the common denominator of them is the temple worship and the temple commemoration, which is in a way a continuation of the same Teichalot literature. However, the Teichalot literature is also interested in the temple, in the angelic priests, in the variety of divine worship in heaven. Now, the new Kabbalah does not say the same things, only it shares the same interest. When we look, like in a brief view on what is the content of the first Kabbalistic writing, the answer is Soda Menorah, Soda Shema Meforash, Soda Mikdash. They are talking within the priestly world. Now, it doesn't mean that they themselves are priests. They might be, they might not, but their interest is priestly. They're talking on the sacrifices, they're already on Sodot HaKorbanot, on the secrets of the sacrifices, they're talking on Soda Menorah, on the secrets of the seven candles Menorah from the temple, they're talking on the priestly way of life, on priestly clothes, on priestly purity, on priestly exceptional look. They're interested in the commemoration of the priesthood, in the commemoration of the temple, feeling that this is a living being. Now that's the nature of the mystical part. I repeat, when we look on those first writings that came down to us, the obvious common denominator is the priestly interest or the priestly law. I wish to remind you that according to the Talmudic tradition and biblical tradition, only Kohanim are allowed to say the Shema Meforash. Only Kohanim are allowed to bless with the Shema Meforash. Only Kohanim are allowed to enter into the Holy of Holies. All that is now being appropriated through this new mystical law. There are numerous explanations for this point. Some say because of the Karaim, who were adopting the idea of Avelei Tzion, the Karaim were very much interested in commemorating the Avelut, how do you say Avelut?
Morning.
The morning on the destruction of the temple. They were saying to themselves that they should not eat and they should not drink and they should dress black clothes. They are like Avelim all the time on the destruction of the temple. As against the new Kabbalistic circles are interested in the Mikdash, but not as Avelim, not as mourners, not as people who are mourning, but as people who are living the priestly law in their spirit, in their mind. Now, in this mind, spiritual way, they would append to this strictures of behavior, like they would demand from themselves high degree of tohara, high degree of purity. They would demand from themselves higher degrees of prishut, higher degrees of asceticism. They would demand themselves particular self-commitment. They would talk on hakdashat alumdim. They would see themselves as consecrated, as holy, as committed, according to the priestly pattern. Again, it is interesting and not exclusive. It's not only priestly, but the major thing which takes immediate attention is the fact that there is a great deal of priestly law in the beginning of the Kabbalah. So we would not be surprised in the 13th century to read, which we would read together a little later, descriptions of the high priest entering to the Holy of Holies, while there is no Holy of Holies for at least 1,000 years. But for them, within the mystical spiritual world, there is a serving priesthood, there is a temple in heaven. They can describe it in a present process as an ongoing worship. All that is very interesting, and it is taking place in the center of the halakhic rabbinic world. They are expanding the spiritual courses of scholarship, they are expanding the spiritual dialogue with halakha, with agadah, with rabbinic tradition, with poetic tradition, with liturgical tradition. They are talking with it all. They're not exclusive. The same people who are writing the Hasagot al Rambam would be the same people who are writing the new Kabbalistic treatise. It is not any marginal, unknown circles. It is the very center of leadership of the Spanish and French houses of leadership. The next stage. I'm not saying now anything about the Zohar of the 13th century. We will discuss it later. I would just like to say again very shortly on the way that Kabbalah is developing. When it is taking place in France and Spain, it is within the Batei Midrash. It is an oral tradition with very short encoded treatises about it. However, after the expulsion from Spain, which is easy to remember because it's the same date of the discovery of America, 1492, after the expulsion of Spain, the whole idea of Kabbalah and mysticism is spreading out in the whole entire Jewish community. And why is this? Because people were looking for an explanation for the atrocity, for the tragedy, for the devastation of a great deal of the Jewish people. Kabbalah offers a structure, a meaning, a framework for the devastation of a Christian. And why is that? Because it offers, in a new way, in an innovative way, the connection between Kabbalah, Mashiach, and Geulah. Between the mystical writing and the study of the mystical writing, between the messianic idea and the coming of the Messiah, and redemption. Kabbalah was able to offer a dialectic, profound framework of the relations between exile and redemption. Halakha could not offer that, rabbinic leadership could not offer that, sacred text could not offer it. The only book that was able to offer an answer, a frame, a way of thinking which would answer the atrocities of the expulsion was the Kabbalistic circle. How did they do it? We will discuss it a little later in our course. But for the time being, remember, it is the combination of messianism and mysticism which gives the response to the tragedy of existence. And tragedies, there were numerous. The 1492 expulsion is the summit of a whole long series of banishments and exiles and persecutions and then forced conversion and all that. The only group that was able to give an answer, a meaning, a vocation to the atrocities of existence was Kabbalah. The result of this was that in the early decades of the 16th century, the expulsion was in the last decade of the 15th century, in the early decade of the 16th century, those five people, Shlomo Morfo, Yosef Karo, Shlomo Alkabe, Moshe Kordoverbo, were the proponents of the new Kabbalah that changed the whole entire history of Judaism. What did those people say? They took upon themselves to revive the textual tradition. Try to think for a moment on it like musical score and performance. The musical score was the Zohar. The performers, the new performers, the new interpreters were those people. The result of the new performance is the expulsion, the complete catastrophe, the tragedy. The people who take the old score, they don't need to write new books, they take the old score of the Zohar, but they are reading it in a new way. They make themselves to be the proponents of the new voice which is coming through the old text. Again, we would read it and we would see it in detail. For the time being, all of you need is to recall that the passage from Kabbalah as an esoteric concern of high elitistic circles into Kabbalah as a broad expanded cultural reaction to atrocities of existence is taking place through those people. The interesting thing is that Shlomo Morfo is a Maran, a convert who was born as a Christian to a Jewish family under the strictures of enforced religion in Portugal, who was converting back into Judaism in an elderly age, like 18 or 20, circumcised himself, studied Hebrew, started to write books, and affected a great deal the Kabbalist circles in Turkey. Yosef Karo was among those who were much affected by Shlomo Morfo. As a result of the meeting between Morfo and Karo, Karo, who was a renowned legalistic writer, as you all know, became to be a mystical writer. The mystical diary of Yosef Karo, known as Magid Meisharim, is the most important mystical document of the 16th century. Because he was able to revive the text, not only to read it, to write it, to teach it, he was able to live. He perceived himself as Moses of his generation, and I do not exaggerate. He perceived himself as the person who gives the new law, who hears the divine word, who is the redeemer of the people from slavery into redemption. And in fact, he came to the land of Israel in 1535 as a result of a complicated process that we will discuss later. However, he is the founder of the Kabbalistic Center of Safed, and without him, nothing would have taken place. So the first 30 years of the 16th century are the formative foundation of the post-expulsion Kabbalah. Everything important is taking place there. New rituals, new literature, new world perception, dissemination of Kabbalah all over the Jewish world. After that foundation was erected, the next stage, which is known as Kabbalah Ha'ari, or the Loryani Kabbalah, is taking place. Now this Loryani Kabbalah is more well known than the Karo Alphabet Cordovero. However, this is a misperception. Without this stage of Morfo, Karo, Alphabet, and Cordovero, none of that could have been taking place. Now next to Ha'ari, which is called Chaim Vital, who was his writer and his disseminator, and many others next to him, Chaim Vital and Ha'ari, that's the abbreviation of Ha'elohi, Rabbi Yitzchak, Luria. However, his Loryanic writings, or the Loryanic teachings, could have had the effect that they had on the foundation of the Kabbalistic work that those people get. I draw one more time again your attention to the fact that people who are leaders in the halakhic world, in the Jewish leadership, in the world of books and halakha and law, are the same people who are the source of the mystical writings, the mystical inspiration. In Judaism, we don't have the very common phenomenon like in the Christian world that mystics are the rebellion margin. Not at all. In Judaism, mysticism is from the very heart of rabbinic leadership. People like Nachmanides, Ramban, people like Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, people like Rabbi Ezra and Rabbi Azriel, the beginning of the Kabbalah, are all central people within the rabbinic halakhic tradition. At the very same time, they are the proponents of the new spiritual world, which is called, which is worked stage by stage. So we are talking on the center and the dissemination of new explorations of spiritual world. There is no conflict here, and there is like expanding and continuing. Yes.
I understand that these mainstream leaders, but was there an acceptance throughout the community, or was it something that was viewed still as, you know, because I forgot the exact term you said with the Kadesh, the Bahamian, the Shaman.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like Armenian viewing it from a contemporary perspective, but it's something that I'm sure that came up with that. I don't think.
Well, it depends who is this somebody. If the leader of the shul would say, "Nitchadesh v'det nidrashenu," we probably would accept it. As I said, the somebody that suggests a new idea, if this somebody, somebody like Yosef Karo, you cannot contradict him on...
You can't cross the street to the other shul. You don't cross the street to the other shul.
Well, however, it doesn't mean that everything was accepted unanimously all the time. However, nothing could have been rejected as marginal or as wrong, because it comes from the people who lack in the halakhic authority. This is not the case. Those people are within the halakhic mainstream. Only they are expanding it. They are exploring it into new directions beyond the day-to-day halakhic hegemony traditional one. Okay?
Yes. Aside from Mr. Karo or any of the other, at least four handles,
Chaim Vital was the rabbi of Damascus. I mean, he was not a marginal person. He certainly was not a Amalek. He was the rabbi of Damascus. He was the Damascus was a great Jewish community. He was the rabbi of Damascus for most of his life. Cordovero was an halakhic person and authority and rabbinical one. Now, not everyone is Yosef Karo, of course, but all those people were considered to be people of great eminence and importance in their time and place. On Nachmanides, I don't need to elaborate, on Rashba and Rajid and so on and so forth. But the obvious example of people who are at the same time halakhic writers and mystical writers is Ramban and Rabbi Yosef Karo. And later on we can say the same on the Gaon Mivilna. You know, he was halakhic authority, spiritual authority, and mystical authority. So in the Jewish case, those things can work together. Yes.
Just coming back to the sixth, isn't Cordovero and Alcala different schools?
No, not at all. They're all related. Alcabet and Cordovero are brothers-in-law, something like that, and they are also related to Karo. They're all like in family relations. No, they're not different schools at all. They are all adoring and admiring Karo, because Karo was the person who was considered to be endowed with divine spirit. Nobody else claimed that he has the divine degree that Karo did. Karo, as I said, was perceiving himself as Moshe Rabbeinu, who is endowed with a new spirit, with a new law, with a new perception, and more as Moshe. He was a redeemer, a lawgiver, and the person who changed the historical and spiritual course of his people. Karo saw himself like that, and since we have mystical diaries, we can substantiate it profusely.
So the Ari was a founder of Karo?
No, Ha'ari is a person who is spiritually endowed on his own account, not as a student of Karo. Okay? He was a student of Rabbi David Ibn Zimra in Halakha, but he was not a student of anybody in Kabbalah, in this sense. He was an individual who acquired it by himself through reading and through spiritual gifts. The same was with Karo. Karol was a student of Tsitsipas, of Yosef Tsitsipas, who was mainly an halakhic leader in Turkey, and around this he was gifted with the Turk. And as I said, on Karol we know the exact details of his skills, I think, but not now.
Wasn't
Kavod
at the end the student of Marius?
I'm sorry?
Kavod at the end became a Hamilton.
No. We need to be very precise on this. Ha'ari was working between 1572 and 1575. Karo passed away. Karo was blessed with very long life. He was born in the 80s of the 15th century and he lived until 1575 of the 16th century. At the time it was incredibly long life. Alphabet and Cordovero were familiar with the Ari only on the margins, and they were certainly not part of this group. They were part of this group, of Karo, Alphabet, Cordovero, and others.
When
did he die? I'm sorry?
When did he die?
Karo, 1575. The same year they both died in the same year, although he was born when he came to Tsapo. Ha'ari was born more or less in 1535 and passed in 1575 as a young man of 40 years old.
He was born?
According to one tradition, and 1488 15th century. Now, as I said, this is only a schematic review of that in order to understand how Kabbalah and mysticism are working. We would spend some time on each one of those. We want to say one word on Elohi Rabbi Yitzchak, on Isaac Loria. He offered a noble perception of mysticism. And when one asks what it is, a noble perception of mysticism, the answer is entirely new perception of the deity, entirely new perception of the relations between the divine and the earthly, a new reading of the sacred text, and a world which is entirely new. However, if you would have asked him, what did you innovate? He would say, and so he said, I didn't innovate anything. I just read the Zohar profoundly. I'm a student of the Zohar. So he introduced himself. Now, his reading of the Zohar is very free, innovative, creative way. He's right that the Zohar is his foundation, but he took the Zohar tradition far, far away from where the Zohar of the 13th century left. Now we're making historical skip. Luria continued that, what I showed you here, the connection between Kabbalah and Messianism and Geulah and Galut. Those four elements, exile and redemption, Messiah and Kabbalah, were all united in the 16th century. Luria took it one step further. He was paving the way to the Messianic era. Shabbatai Tzvi, the proponent of Tibetanism, with Nathan of Alba, Shabbatai Tzvi, those two were taking the Lurianic and the Zohar, mainly the Zohar writing, but in a world that was profused with the Lurianic ideas, with waiting for the Messianic era and all that, they took it one step further. They said that the Messianic era had begun already. We will not go now into details because this is a complicated issue. The only thing I wish you to know that there is no such a thing as a false Messiah. There is such a thing as a false reality. Reality is the false thing, not the Messiah. He intended, Shabbatai Tzvi, every prophet, Nathan Me'aza, were both sincere people who had meant very profoundly to pave the way to redemption and to the Messianic era, believing that they are capable to it. They didn't do much more than what Karo at this time and Luria at this time were trying to do. Only reality worked against them more and more. As a result of the reality, they found themselves in a place that they never meant to be. Shabbatai Tzvi found himself convert to Islam against his will because he was given a choice by the Sultan, by the Turkish Sultan, like that. Or you would convert to Islam, or you would be beheaded tomorrow morning. He chose chose like many before him to convert or to pretend to convert in order to save his life, the result of it was a paradox. The idea of a converted Messiah, like the idea, it's a part of his heart. He didn't need to be a converted Messiah. He found himself a converted Messiah. However, like in the case of Christianity, a crucified Messiah is the starting point of Christianity. That's the theological well of Christianity. In the same way, the converted Messiah in Judaism in the 17th century was the springboard for a whole Sabbatian theory, theology, overwhelming spiritual aspects, which affected all Jewish communities. Don't believe that they were sectarian or marginal. They were the most effective spiritual phenomenon in the 18th century and in the 17th century. Historically, there were rabbis who said there was not a single Jewish community without Sabbatian people. Major rabbis of the Jewish community, Shlomo Aiyon, the rabbi of Amsterdam, Eibeshit, the rabbi of Prague, many of them were Sabbatians, many of them later converted. The effect of the word,
thank you very much,
to Christianity. The son of Jonathan Eibeshit was a convert, was a Christian convert, son of Knell of Flavi was also a convert to Christianity. Lives are always much more complicated than the square way. No, there is, it's a whole reason for the conversion. Again, we are not doing now Sabbatianism. All what we want to do now is the fact, the historical, very short historical survey explaining that mysticism that started here in the 12th, 13th century, at Century Divine, the temple, sacrifices, Shemesh, priestly scriptures, and things like that, found itself in the 17th century at 59 Gates of Tum'ah and Defilement, trying to think that they are paving the way to the Messianic era. This is the dialectic of mysticism, that you know where you start, you don't know where you end. They found themselves converting into Islam in Turkey. They are called the Dhammit, which means the top Arabic people, Dhammit, those who are converted to Islam. By the way, there are Turkish Dhammit until today. They asked the Rabbanut in Israel to acknowledge them as Jews, they were rejected. But the Dhommeh are living from the 17th century until today. Those who were converted to Islam are called Dhommeh. Those who converted to Christianity were called Frankists or Frankism after the name of Jacob Frank. In 1757, in Lvov, in Galicia, 500 Jewish families were converted publicly to Christianity. Just to give you an idea, nobody enforced them. They chose to be. The difference is that Shabbatai Tzvi was enforced, and as a result of this enforcement, a whole new theology of mitzvah haba be'averah was developed. Mitzvah haba be'averah is a commandment through sin, right? But those, the Frankists, were not enforced. They chose to convert. Why did they choose to convert? That's a complicated issue. But first of all, they chose, they were not enforced. The Dhommeh chose to convert to Islam. They were not enforced. There were numerous Jews who were enforced to convert to Christianity. I'm not talking on them. They are the Mahana. I'm talking on Jews who chose, as a result of the belief in the Messianic era, to convert. Now, at the very same time, because of that it's important to see the chronology, at the very same time that Christian converts, Frankists, Dhommeh, Muslim converts, all of that were working, Hasidism was also working. Hasidism is a phenomenon of the 18th century, second half of 18th century, exactly the high time of Frankism converting to Christianity. The Baal Shem Tov and Yaakov Frank are co-leaders of the same time, of the same period, of the same area. Only one of them, the Baal Shem Tov, is working within the constraints of tradition, trying to build an entirely new spiritual avenue. At the very same time, Yaakov Frank is working and convincing and reaching out for the same members of the same Jewish community who have to choose between this and that, between the Hasidic way and between the Frankish way. Many chose this and many chose that. I said that in order to understand it, for understanding Hasidism in Galicia, second part of 18th century, we better understand very carefully Frankism in Galicia in the second half of the 18th century. Yes.
There's a great difference, I mean, in the continuation, because the group in the spot, they affiliate themselves strongly with Halakha. The outside Tzvi was very against Halakha.
Yes, this is true. All Jews, with the exception of Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of Allah, everyone that I wrote here, was strongly affiliated with the halakhic tradition. That was the Muvan Me'elav. That was for granted. I mean, to be against halakha was unheard of. It was impossible. It was, you know, if one could not live within the halakhic way, one would apologize. It would have a very good reason. They, not only they did not apologize, they reversed against it on a theological ground. Claiming, taking the verse Torah ki Torah mi titese, they read it according to one of the midrashim ki Torah hadasha mi titese, and they said that this is the new messianic era which calls for a new Torah. But I don't want now to go into
this.
This
would have made it a false messiah. If he would have played the game with Halakha, maybe he wouldn't fail.
Well, as I said, we are not judging them, we are trying to understand what was going on. However, as I said, when they started, when Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of Ara started, both of them were fully committed to Halakha. They were not against Halakha. But both of them, they came from rabbinic families, they had traditional education and all of this. But circumstances turned them into a place in an unexpected place. Should Shabtai Tzvi was not enforced to convert by the Turkish Sultan, it might all have been very different. But because of the fact that he was enforced to convert and he had to envision the idea of Mitzvah, blah, 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 a whole new administration. Now, our point is now not to elaborate the basis. All that I want to say is that the whole entire Jewish history is imbued with different avenues. Now, I could have added many more names and books. I don't want to do that. I just want to give you an overview, a general overview, making somewhat of a childish remark, but maybe it would enable you to remember. There are only three people for a generation. Like my mother, myself, and my daughter are covering a century. There are only three people for a century. So if we talk on 20th century, we are talking only on a line of 60 people. They are not far from us. They are very close to us. For a course of a whole entire century, it's only three people. As I said, your father, yourself, and your son, or my mother, myself, and my daughter. It doesn't take more than three people, one of life, to cover a century. They are not different people. They are like us. Only historical circumstances were different. And I would like to go to the following statement. There is no evolution in the spirit of humankind. There might be an evolution of the physical world or biological world. There is no evidence for evolution of the spiritual world. We should not think that the people who wrote the Qumran or Sefer Yetzirah or Sefer Chalot or Rashi Kabbalah or Kabbalah or Hasidut are eminently different than people that we know. They are very similar. They are suffering from the same thing, they are afraid of the same thing, they are happy about the same thing. The only thing which is different is the historical circumstances. People who are living under persecution are responding profoundly different than people who are living under safety and security circumstances of life. But there is no fundamental difference. There is no difference between people of the 16th century, 2nd century, 1st century. Never think that we are wiser than Plato, more gifted than the author of the Psalms, more brilliant than Isaiah or Jeremiah. There is no development in human spirit. There is a development in human technology. There is a development in human knowledge. But there is no development in human spirit. The later is not necessarily any better than the former. We can say that technological knowledge of the 20th century is far greater than technological knowledge of the 12th century. That would be certainly true. However, we have no right to assume that our knowledge, our spiritual capacity, our inspiration is greater in any century. The same inspiration is available for people in every given century. Having said that, one moment for questions or remarks, and if not, we would go back to yes. Eliyahu of Vilna, was the Gaon of Vilna, was contributing to the mystical, well, to the mystical tradition of the Zohar, and he was doing agahot. He was doing careful reading, pursuing the exact text and the meaning. He did not initiate a new system, but he contributed illuminations and understandings of the textual verse. But we cannot ascribe to him a new system, we can ascribe to him a great dikdukim and agahot and perceptions of it. Now again, we should remember that people who are great halakhic authorities might well be a great kabbalistic. Okay, now leaving that behind, leaving the historical survey, just pointing out the complexity. Let's go back now to something which is far more complicated and might be sort of alarming to some of you, but please bear with me and remember that history is more complicated than what usually are. Now we are living all these 2,000 years and we are going back to this point. And the reason that we are going back to this point is because this is the foundation of the mystical tradition, which would last time and again in various avenues, unexpected ones. In order to understand what was going on in the second century before the common era, we need a little bit of history and a great deal of patience. But let me start by the following assertion. We are all very well familiar with the 2000 years of Masoret Chazal, of the faith tradition. Often we are mistaken to think that this is the only thing that was. This is a mistake. Chazal, or the sages tradition, is the central tradition, no doubt, but it is not the only tradition. There are numerous other voices which are not part of the sages tradition. Now what I'm going to suggest in the following historical description, in the next hour that we is that the sages are no continuation of the biblical Israelite, but they are the revolution of the biblical Israelite. Usually our classical perception is that the Torah is number one and the Mishnah is number two and so on. What I'm trying to say is that the biblical era, that is, let's say a general way, the 2000 years before the common era, were certainly not part of the sages. The sages tradition is after the common era. What was going on before the common era, the biblical Israel, was not within the constraints of the sages tradition. It was within the priestly and prophetic tradition. And to try to say it succinctly, the first thing that the sages do when they form their new perception is to close all the sources of authority of biblical Israel. If we are talking on biblical Israel, we are talking on direct divine revelation known as prophecy. We are talking on written tradition known as Chumash or Torah. We are talking on direct divine revelation, on prophecy, on scriptures. We are talking on tribes, we are talking on kingdoms. None of this is available in the sages. And not only as a result of changing historical circumstances. On the contrary, because of a decision claiming that one period was ending and a new period beginning. Now why is this and when did it say this? We have to go back to the second century before the common era. I mentioned it in our first meeting, but now I will elaborate the historical circumstances that were going on. entire millennia, the whole 10th century before the Common Era, there was a temple in Jerusalem. In the temple, there were serving the priests, the sons of Sadok and the high priesthood, and other 24 priestly courses as nominated in Chronicles chapter 24. The priestly service and the priestly courses and the Levitical courses, all that are, of course, described in the biblical tradition, but all together, they were much more than what we know in the biblical tradition. They were the scribes, they were the teachers, they were the transmitters of the Torah, as we know from various verses, to say, Kohen Ishmeru Dati Malach Adonai Tvotu, but in the blessing of Moshe to the Levi'im, they are those who are, how? The Levites, the Kohanim, are responsible on teaching of the law, on transmitting of the law. Now they're not allowed to keep it to themselves. They are commanded to teach and disseminate and introduce it to many, to all the entire community. We don't have esoteric knowledge kept only for the priests. They are commanded to teach and disseminate the priestly knowledge that they have been entrusted in their hands. They have been doing it for thousand years. They were entrusted in it for 1,000 years. They were very precise about it. They had much documentation about it. Their legitimacy was on the written scripture. They are those who write it, who transmit it, who teach it, who tell it, and they are the center of hegemony, legitimacy, holiness, and power. In the course of those 1,000 years of biblical Israel, from the United Kingdom in the 10th century BC until the destruction of the temple in 70 CE, the majority of this time, the priests who were in charge on everything are those, the name Sadok, a Kohanim named Sadok. The high priesthood, where the high priest, the only one who was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies to do the Yom Kippur rites, to do the priestly blessing, and so on, was only from the family of Melchizedek. All that was taking place according to biblical history and according to extra biblical documentation. We have every reason to believe that the biblical record is reflecting what was going on. If you would read the books of Ezra, the books of Nehemiah, the books of Divrei Hayamim, you would find the detailed line of the priestly families of the house of Sadok. They are counting it from the days of Aharon, father of Elazar, father of Pinchas, father of Buki, father of Yogli, and it goes on and on. It's all written down generation after generation. Until the 2nd century, until the 80s and 70s of the 2nd century before the Common Era, when the two children of the last high priest, the last legitimate high priest, Shimon HaTzadik or Shimon ben Yochanan, who officiated in the 80s of the 2nd century before the Common Era, he was the last legitimate priest of the house of Sadok. He had two children, one was Honyo and one was Yoshua Yazon. Honyo is known in English as Onaya, right like that. And Yoshua Yazon is known as David. Both of them were his children. Only one of them, Onaya, was the one who was supposed to officiate after his father. Onaya the third was the one who was supposed to officiate after his father. He didn't have a chance because his brother Jason deposed him and destroyed him, taking the opportunity that the new Seleucid rulership was introduced into the country. The house of the Seleucids, those who were coming from Seleucia, Seleucus, Beth Seleucus, Seleucians, were the Greek Syrian rulers that their Bilal, their capital was Antiochia. They were relations of Alexander Mogdon, who conquered the Middle East in the 4th century before the Common Era, right? The Seleucians were part of the Diadochs, those who inherited Alexander Mogdon, those who divided the tremendous, huge empire between Egypt, Ptolemy, Syria, Philippi. Okay, they divided it somewhere. Some took the northern part, that's the Seleucians, Seleucians. Some took the southern part, that's the Ptolemaic Romans. In the course of the 3rd century, the Ptolemaic or Ptolemaic, or the way that I'm not sure how we write it exactly in English, in Hebrew we write it Beth Ptolemaic. Something like that. Maybe remember that they were associated with the Cleopatra. They had all kinds of bad things about them, but they had one good thing. They left the Israelites, who were under the rule along the 3rd century, to do whatever they were free. They did not interfere in any way in the religious leadership of the Israelites that were running the temple under the hands of the Kohanim Bnei Tzadok. They were closely associated. The Kohanim Bnei Tzadok were officiating in the temple. The Ptolemaic said, we want the taxes in time and the rest doesn't matter, you do what you want. In the course of the 3rd century, in Israel, there was no upheaval or uprising or anything like that. But in the year 200, the Seleucians took over from the Ptolemaic. From 200 onwards, the land of Israel was taken over by the Seleucians, the northern land. Okay, the Ptolemaics are the southern Egyptians, the Seleucians are the northern Syrians. Okay? From 200 on, until the Roman conquest in 63 BC, Beth-Seleucus is the only ruler of the land of Israel. Okay? Seleucians, 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 and Theophanes, all the same. Now, the difference is that the Seleucians had their own way on doing things. Unlike the Ptolemaic, who said, give us these taxes and do whatever you want, the Seleucians had their own idea on ruling order. Their ruling order, number one, was in all our imperial vicinity, we would have one calendar. And we would have monthly birthday of the king in the day that we dictate according to our own calendar. Okay? Not a religious matter, it is administrative decision. The calendar of the Antiochians, of the Seleucians, is the Greek calendar, which is a lunar calendar. The Greek lunar calendar is an ancient phenomenon. We have assessments only from centuries gone by. The Greeks were always under lunar calendar. The Jews were under solar calendar. Now, that's the thing that most of us don't know. But until the days of Antiochus, the Jewish biblical calendar was a solar calendar, was a priestly calendar, not a lunar calendar. Now, the calendar that we have today is a decision and the choice of the sages, regardless to the point that it was imposed on us by Antiochus. They probably didn't know it at the time when they decided. However, historically speaking, in the course of the 800 years from the temple in Jerusalem and until the 2nd century before the Common Era, the only calendar in the temple was a solar calendar. And we will speak in a moment what is a solar calendar. But what is important about it is that it has a number of the days of the year and is a number of the days of the month. You may recall that in our Bible there is nowhere even a hint on how many days there is in a year and how many days there are in a month. Nobody, if I ask you how many days are in a year according to the Bible, nobody is able to give me an answer. Because nowhere in the Bible we are told how many days are in a year. Nobody in the Bible we are told, directly or indirectly, how many days are in a month. There is only one place, and we will see it later, where we are told indirectly how many days there are. But directly in the Bible we don't have how many days. Now, the Bible... Well, it shows one thing, that why when we look on the literature of the people in number two, we have the parallel of the Bible with one exception. In their Bible, there is a number of days to the year, and there is a number of days to the month. As against us, just a second. Now, the point that I want to make is the combination of the theological issue and the historical issue. This person, Jesus, who officiated in the 70s under Antiochus Epiphanes, agreed to comply to the lunar Antiochian calendar. He said, look, do what you want as long as I can be the high priest. I would buy it from you. And Antiochus said, yeah, you'll buy it with a lot of money, but you also would comply to my ministerial calendar. I don't care at all about your own religious business. I'm not interfering, but I demand that the calendar would be the imperial calendar. Jason, who was a bad guy and who deposed his brother, accepted it. Now, everybody else detested it because this was a profound change from the historical calendar. Now, this Jason was deposed by Menelaus and then by Alcimus, the word of spring priests, who accepted the Antiochian imposition of the lunar calendar. However, we know that later on, the Hasmonaim were conducting a revolution. The Hasmonean revolution was taking place between 167 and 264. At the end of the revolution, they were able to throw away the Greek Antiochians from the defiled temple. However, what they forget to say, that those to be in charge are not really the Greek Antiochians. It is those people, Jason, Menelaus, and Alcimus, who were illegitimate priests, who complied with the Antiochian order. When the Maccabim or the Hasmonaim were running the revolution against the Greek Antiochian Seleucid system, they were able to receive some kind of independence, very some kind. We like to think that we have an independent country in the days of the Hasmonaim. This is not true. We were semi-sovereign little place under the huge Seleucid Empire. Now, their condition didn't change. They wanted the same thing as they wanted always. They said, we would allow you a great deal of freedom, but not in regard of the calendar. The calendar is our condition, and you cannot change it. So the Antiochian calendar was imposed in the Hasmonean period just as well. They did not manage to reinstitute the ancient calendar. Those who mentioned the ancient calendar were those, the Kohanim Neifedot. In their calendar, the year has 364 days. Every month has 30 days, and every third month has 31 days. We would now read a very short text that would show us what is the structure of the ancient priestly calendar. Before we read, one question to get.
As far as the dating, just to think that the solar calendar is the same as the biblical calendar.
Okay.
Although, I remember in Parshat Noah, the ark is approached for the lunar number of days.
No, or the solar number of days. That is, now let's check, okay? Noah entered the Teva in the 17th of the 7th month, according to the Bible, right? And he came out in the 27th of the 7th month in the year after, right? He entered in the 17th of the 7th month of the year 600. Everyone had what? Did I see that ready? Everyone had. Okay. Now, listen, don't write on the structure of the flood calendar, okay? Noah entered to the ark in the 17th of the 2nd month. 150 days later, we are told that it's Teivan Naha al Harei Arara. We are told that in the middle of the seventh month, that is the 15th or the 17th, of the seventh month, this Teva, the ark, rested on the mountains of Ararat, and we are told 150 days later. According to which lunar calendar, 150 days can pass from the middle of the second month to the middle of the seventh month? Do you know that in a lunar calendar there are alternatively 29 and 30? Now you'll compile, put together, 29 plus 30. 29 plus 30 and 29, that's 5 months. That does not come to 150 days. The only way that we can have 150 days between the 17th of the second month and the 17th of the seventh month is only according to solar calendar. So, we would...
140.
Okay, because of that we are told that it is in the 14th. We would look into that, okay? Look. Okay, because why? Because it goes like this. Okay. This is the way that a year looks. In every, I'm sorry on the quality of the bone, but in every quarter there are 91 days, okay? And in every quarter there are 13 Shabbatot. Shabbat HaKul Shlomet is in Vepa. There are 13 Saturdays, 13 Saturdays, 13 Saturdays, and 13 Saturdays. Until here, that may not be a problem, but here comes the problem. According to the solar calendar, every year and every quarter would always start in the same day. Which day that would be?
Shabbat.
I'm sorry?
Shabbat.
No, why Shabbat? Which one? No, impossible.
Wednesday.
Why Wednesday? Because we have the Me'or. Because only in Wednesday we have the way to differentiate between day and night. Only in Wednesday we have sun for the day and moon for the night. In order to calculate it all, you must have a sun and the moon. You must have a day and a night. Only in Wednesday, open Genesis. Genesis chapter 8, there is first. Anybody with the Bible? What is that? Sukkim Rishonim, Perek Aleph Bereshit. The Yom Ravi. What we are told about Yom Ravi? The Koran. The Koran? But before that, before Me'orot Berekia HaShamayim, Le'adil Ben Hayom Uben HaLayla, we cannot count days, right? So we can start counting only on Wednesday. Now, look here. This one would be a Wednesday, okay? That one would be a Wednesday, but let's say that this is the first day. This one would be a Wednesday, and this one would be a Wednesday. Every one of these quarters would start with a Wednesday. Now, if every one of these quarters would start with a Wednesday and with a date, we can tell the date and the day of every day of the year, which is not the case with the lunar calendar. Only with the solar calendar. Let's say I claim the following. Wednesday is the first of the first. Okay? Only Wednesday can be the first of the first. So let's say that we are going to this quarter. That would be the quarter of the start, of the September, okay? This one is spring, this one is summer, this one is autumn, this one is winter, okay? If this one is Wednesday, the first of the first of this quarter is Wednesday, this is Rosh Hashanah, right? Then Yom Kippur would be on Friday, 10 days later.
Huh? Shabbat.
Pesach is in Wednesday, and Shavuot would be on Sunday, and Omer would be on Sunday. Every day has a day. Every day has a day. If only you start by the first step I started. If the Yom Kippur Me'orot, Wednesday, is the first day of every quarter, from beginning until the end of the day, then we have a day and a day for every holiday. the idea of the omen, Maharat Shabbat, is Nimokwat Shabbat after Pesach. The first Pesach, if it starts in the 15th, it ends in the 22. The first available Saturday is the 25, so Nimokwat Shabbat would be the 26th. So, the 26th of the first, which always would be Sunday, would be the day of the omen. Okay? First, the 7th Saturday later, which one day comes? Shavuot. 7th Saturday next on Sunday, on the 15th of the third month, is Chag Shavuot, according to this. You remember in our tradition, we have no date for Chag Shavuot. 7 Saturdays later, we have a holiday, which is not a usual holiday in our tradition, but it is mentioned. It is called Chag Hayam, Chag Tirosh. You remember the compound Dagan Tirosh Vit. How? Dagan is the holiday of the Dagan, is this one. The 15th of the third month is Chag HaBikur and Chag HaShavuot. 7 Saturdays later is the holiday of the Tirosh, which is the first one. 7 Saturdays later, it is the holiday of the first oil, the third of Av. It's Chag HaKurea itself. But we would leave those holidays right now, and we would go to the next holidays in line. The next holidays would be, after, if this is Shavuot, the 15th of the third month, the classical holiday in the list of Ele Moadei Adonai Asher Bimoada, the next holiday is Yom Zikaron Tvuah. As you know, in the Bible we don't have Rosh Hashanah. It is called Yom Zikaron Tvuah. This is always in the first of the seventh. It would always would be on Wednesday. That the next holiday is Yom Kippur, which is on the 10th of the seventh, and it would always be on Friday. The next holiday is Sukkot, which is on the 15th of the seventh month, and it is always on Wednesday. Now, this is the way that the old priesthood perceived the holiday. This is the one subject that the sages disagree completely. They said, of course we would remember all the holidays, but we would calculate it, not according to predetermined holiday calendar, as it is here with this perfect symmetric organized way. You may see that this is Pesach in the 15th of the Hadamatot, 15th of the first month. This is Shavuot, 15th of the third month, and this is Sukkot, 15th of the seventh month. I'm sorry.
What's the purpose of that?
Well, they're all in the middle of the month.
That's true according to
No. According to Chazal, Shavuot is in the sixth. Yeah. Anyhow, now. There is one striking thing about it. First of all, never Chag Nofel al Shabbat. A great deal of the Chazal discussion is, what do you do when Shabbat and Chag are overlapping? Here, never Chag and Shabbat are overlapping because every Chag has its own day and date. Every Chag has its own predetermined, pre-calculated place in the calendar of the year.
So the Pesach and Sukkot still overlap.
I'm sorry?
Pesach and Sukkot still overlap.
Okay, but they're not starting on Shabbat. Every holiday would be more than every holiday would start in the middle of the weekend. Every 7 days, naturally, it would have. Yeah, but it wouldn't start on Shabbat. They would not, it would not be. In our calendar, Chag HaShavuot could be in every day of the week. Except Sunday. In our calendar, you all remember, I'm sure, the exposition Lo Adu Rosh. Remember that? Lo Adu Rosh. Which are exactly the days of the holidays according to the Christian tradition. All the holidays are either in Wednesday, Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. Those are the days that the sages do not allow to start the holiday. Because if you start Rosh Hashanah, the idea Lo Adu Rosh is, you may not have Rosh Hashanah in Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday. You must have Rosh Hashanah on Wednesday, according to this calculation. According to this perception, for them, Wednesday is Yom Bri'at HaMeorot, the day of the creation of the luminaries. This is the only day that you can start. Now, I want to stop right now the very there were many questions that he posed. I want to read with you the meaning of this in the ancient world. We're looking on this, look here. We're looking on that, on the tiny chapter. I will first read it in Hebrew, and then for anyone if it's too hard, follow in the English, which is in the parlor. I'm starting from the second line. Vayehi David ben Ishai, chacham ve'or ke'or shemesh, ve'sofer ve'navon ve'tamim bechol drachav lifnei el ve'anshim. Vayetel lo Elohim ruach nevona ve'ora, ויכתוב תהילים 3600 ושיר לשורר לפני המזבח על עולת התמיד לכל יום ויום לכל ימי השנה 463 ולקורבן השבתות 52 שיר ולקורבן ראשי החודשים ולכל ימי המועדות וליום הכיפורים 30 שיר ויהי כל השיר אשר דיבר 6 ו-44 ושיר לנגן על הפגועים 4, ויהי הכל 4,050. כל אלה דיבר בנבואה אשר נתן לו מלפני האלים. Now this is a very beautiful text, a complicated one, a very short and a very complicated one, which was found in Qumran as part of the psalm. We miss this psalm. In our psalm, this psalm is not available. It is in the same psalm for us we have. We found it in Qumran only in our edition, this psalm is missing. This next psalm which is missing is the psalm which is of the praise of the Kohanim Bnei Tzadok. This psalm which is known as Psalm 151. Now I want to explain what is that, that we read and we'll do it through the English. And David, son of Jesse, was wise and the light like the light of the sun. Pay attention that in this literature, the sun is considered to be of great importance. It is called Luach HaShemesh, the solar calendar, and every place that they can, they would say that the sun is the most important one, and in fact, in the Genesis tradition in Qumran, we are told that there is only sun and not moon when calculating of the appointed times of the Lord should be taken into consideration. But we'll return to it. Now we just want to see that. And David, son of Jesse, was wise and light like the light of the sun, and learned, and discerned, and perfect in all his paths before God and man. And God gave him a discerning and enlightened spirit. And he wrote Psalms, 3,600. Now why did he write 3,600 Psalms? Okay, we will get it now as a question. But we recall that he wrote 3,600. Now we are going to a second thing that he wrote. He wrote songs to be sung before the altar, over the perpetual offering of every day, for all the days of the year. How many songs did he write? 364. This is the number that I wrote over here. Yes, I said that in the year, in the counting of days of the Kohanim Bnei Tzadok, the year had 364 days. This is the number of Shirei Olam HaTamim, which David composed according to this tradition. We are following. And songs to be sung before the altar over the perpetual offering of every day, for all the days of the year 364. And for the Sabbath offering, this is Olat HaShabbat, of course, 52 songs. Now those are extra songs. 52 songs. Why? Because how many Saturdays are in a year? 52, right? Okay. Now, after he wrote those 52 songs, now we need what kind of sacrifices we still need? Musafim, Korban Musaf. When do we offer Korban Musaf? Hadith, right? And where else? Rashei Chodeshim. In Rashei Chodeshim and Chagim, we offer Korban Musaf. And for the Sabbath offering, 52 songs, as we said, we wrote here. And for the offerings of the first days of the month, and for all the days of the festival, and for the Day of Atonement, 30 songs. Now, how many months there are?
Well,
if we are told that altogether he did 30 stones, Rashay for the Shin Ves Tabatot, it means that we have 18 days, right? How do we have 18 days of Dinwati? We have one of Korban Fesach, that's one. We have seven of Fesach, altogether eight, right? Seven Chagamatot. We have one of the Olam, that is 9 days. We have one of Shavuot, that is 10 days. We have seven of Sukkot, that is 17 days, and one of Yom Kippur, that is 18 days. Now, this one is not counted. Why? Because it is a Rosh Chodesh. You cannot give the same stone for the same thing. We have 18 days of the Muadim if we count Rosh Hashanah as a Rosh Chodesh, not as a Chag, right? Do you understand what I mean? Yes.
First of all, there's no record in the Chumash at least that there is any Korban Chag Pesach.
What do you mean? Korban Pesach?
That's a separate. That's like a musa. That's the equivalent of musa for Korban Kippur that are going up with you.
I don't know. I just say that for the Korban, he's counting the days which have extra offering. A different. No. Look, all of those. Just a second. Okay. We have. I need one more and then we will go to the calculation. Let me just finish the reading and write it down. And all the stones which he spoke were 446. Now altogether, all that comes to 446 those, but which is 30. However, we meet another 40. And stones to perform over the possessed. Now this is a poor translation, because the word in Hebrew, if you see, Velenagen al akbuim arba'a. The word kbuim is not possessed. Of course, this is a poor translation. What does it sound for? No, not at all. In Hebrew, in biblical Hebrew, the verb pagah means pagah. Vayifgah bo malach Elohim. Just vayifgah bo malach Elohim. Pagah, those are the meeting days. Those 4 days, like this day and that day, and this day and that day. Those are the 4 extra days where the meeting seasons, where the seasons are meeting each other. They are called the Peguim. It should have been translated as the meeting days, not as the possessed days, as the meeting days. They are extra. Why they are extra? Because every month has 30 days. Those 4 extra days, which we would calculate as the day number 31 of the last month, of the end of the month, those are the Peguim. Okay? Now, if I would be precise, it is not Yom Dalet, it is Yom Gimel, right? It is Yom Gimel and Yom Gimel. So we can say that first of the month, the first of the first, the first of the fourth, the first of the seventh, and the first of the tenth, this is Wednesday. Day 31 here is always Tuesday. This is the Yom Kippur, like the day of the meeting, the day of the meeting. So we have 4 Yom Kippur and 4 Yemei Zikaron. Okay, the 4 Yom Kippur is always Tuesday, the end of the day 91. Okay, we have 30, 30, and 30. Day 91 of the quarter is always Tuesday, and this is the Yom Kippur. The day of the first day of the next quarter is Yom Zikaron. So we have this one is Yom Zikaron, that one is Yom Zikaron, this one is Yom Zikaron, and that one is Yom Zikaron. Yom Zikaron are always Wednesday. Those are the beginning of the course. Okay? Now, all together, we are told that Vayehi Kol Arba Alafim V'Chamishim. All together, all those songs that we did, all together is 4,050. Now we can account easily for those. We understood that the 364 correspond to Korban HaTamim. The 52 correspond to Olah HaShabbat. The 30 corresponds to the Korban Musaf. The 4 corresponds to the 4 extra days. And quarter dose is 3,600. Those are the 10 Tehillims that we should take for every day of the year, which are not associated with sacrifices. Since we have 360 days of the year, with the exception of the 14 days, we have 10 Tehillim for each one of them. So 10 times 360 is 3,600. This book, which is called number one, is the non-sacrificial song. That book is all sacrificial song. Each one of them is corresponding to the sacrifice.
And there was carbonate every day.
What?
You had carbonate every day.
Yes, of course, but this is the 364 carbonate coming, okay? Who is doing that and who is doing that? The 364, there must be Korban HaTamid. The 52 is Olat Shabbat. The 30 is the Musafim. The 4 is the Amin Kud.
Why is it?
Because the 4 are different. Every day of the year. If those 4 are different, the 4 are different. Okay?
All holidays.
No. They are not under holidays. They are under Yamim Kavuim. It says here, look on the text. Ve'lenagen al Kavuim arba'ah. Ve'shir lenagen al Kavuim arba'ah. It says that it's David who singles it out. It's not me. It is singles out of the category. Yes. Of July.
Okay, now, we are living on two currently. Okay, that's okay. I'm very glad.
Now, why can't we say that the young people want to be girls?
Well, it might be, but I don't want to make them as the excuse for this. I want to do it exactly the other way. The calendar that I was speaking about is the priestly calendar, the solar calendar, as it is well attested in Qumran. That does not exclude numerous other systems of cultivation which were among the people. However, I'm talking only on the ritual calendar. When people meet each other, they can say, we will meet in the Saturnalia, which is the Roman holiday. We can meet in the Antiochian 25th day of December, which was the big holiday. People may celebrate and may meet each other and may make transactions according to any system they wish, but they may not make holidays and temple pilgrimage as they wish. This is not upon them. This is upon the Kohanim. I've been speaking only on the solar priestly calendar according to the Kohanim as we found in Qumran. Now, what do we make out of it? As I said, historically, we have every reason to believe that the calendar that was functioning in the temple until the second century before the founding era is the calendar which we call as a solar calendar. We have attestation for that in the Book of Jubilees, in the Book of Enoch, in Qumran, in Apocryphon Genesis, in certain different documents which are not related, in the temple scroll, in the Megillat HaMishmarot, the scroll of the priestly forces. We have numerous reasons to believe and numerous documentation to believe that the calendar that was functioning in the temple was the solar calendar. However, we should ask, if this is the case, why the calendar that we have today is not a solar calendar, but it is a lunar calendar. Now, I said that historically, the order is, first in the temple, only in the temple, there was a solar calendar. Then the people went on exile to Babylon. Where they spent 70 years under lunar calendar in Babylon, not in Israel, in Babylon. The names of the Chodashim, the names of the months, are all Babylonian. In the Pentateuch, the months have no name. They are called the first month, the second month, the third month, and they are mentioned only in relation to the agricultural season, like Chodesh Aviv. Chodesh Azeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, Chodesh Aviv. What is Aviv? Aviv is Teorah, barley. The word Aviv is not fruit, it is barley. Barley is the first thing which is ripening in the land of Israel. Chodesh Aviv is when everyone thinks that the barley is ripe. So in the Pentateuch, in general, the months are called only by ordinal. First month, second month, third month, fifth, and fourth. Only after the return from Babylon, the name of the months were introduced. If you open Encyclopedia Britannica, under Babylonian calendar, you will find that their name is Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev. It's entirely Babylonian, okay? But yeah, Zivan Gul is Melachim, not the Pentateuch. I said independent, correct? Independent, in the Chumash, certainly before Sefer Melachim, the months are only by the ordinal. In the later books of the Bible, after the Babylonian exile, in the Persian period, like for instance in Megillat Esther, very clear, every day is introduced twice, in the Chodesh HaShlishi, who Chodesh Sivan. Like, before there was no need to say, because Chodesh HaShlishi was well understood. After the exile from Babylon, we are introduced in a double way. Like we would say today, Sivan or Union. Okay? They say Chodesh HaShlishi and Sivan. However, the point that I'm trying to make is the following. For 800 years in the temple, there was a solar calendar administered by the priests. In the second century before the common era, Antiochus imposed the lunar calendar on the whole entire kingdom without any religious interpretation. It was only administrative system. He introduced it and his descendants imposed it. Never the Antiochian Seleucian king agreed to have any other calendar. Now, we don't like it. We don't really care for the fact that it is the lunar Antiochian calendar which was imposed, but this is a fact. Now, when the sages introduced their calendar, that's much later, that's in the first century of the Common Era, in the very late decade of the first century before the Common Era, Hillel is corresponding to Herod. Herod came to power in 37 before the Common Era. Hillel is being praised to know what do we know in Pesach Shabbat. Before that, there is this famous question of Nevatera. If Hillel is being praised for the fact that he's the only one who knows what do you do in Pesach Shechal v'Shabbat,
he came from Babel.
Of course. Now, the thing is that why there is such a praise, or why there is need to praise him? Because if it was on a lunar calendar, that would be a very common problem. But it is not a common problem. Only then they have to find out. Now, one moment. Hillel is in the beginning of the process of changing the perception of the calendar. Akiva is the one who inaugurates the change of the calendar. And you can check it in Mishnah Rosh Hashanah. In Mishnah Rosh Hashanah, he takes the verse from Vayikra, from Parashat HaMoedot, chapter 23. In the verse in Vayikra, Vayikra 23, we are told, Ele Moadei Adonai, Asher Tikreu Otam B'Moadam. Not only that, we have three different verses where the word Otam is mentioned. Ushmartem Mitzvati Ve'Achitem Otam Ani Adonai, that's Vayikra Kasbet. Daber El Bnei Yisrael Ve'Amarta Elehem, Ele Moadei Adonai, Asher Tikreu Otam Nikrae Kodesh Elehem Moadai, Vayikra Kasimel. אלה מועדי אדוני מקראי קודש אשר תקראו אותם במועדם. Now, it's very obvious in the Bible that it is אותם. What does רבי עקיבא do in משנה ראש השנה? He said, אלה מועדי אדוני אשר תקראו אתם. He doesn't say the word במועדם in their appointed time. That's the end of the sentence. אלה מועדי אדוני אשר תקראו אתם. He takes the word אותם. In the Bible, it's very obviously Otam, and you read it like Atem. He sort of disregards the Cholam, and he reads it as Atem, which means you. And in the Gemara Rosh Hashanah, they say, Atem, 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 Atem afilu shogedim, Atem afilu medidim, Atem afilu mutim. This is a revolutionary moment. Rabbi Akiva decides that a new system is inaugurated. A new system is inaugurated. Not Elemo de Adonai Ashatik Rewotam Bemo Adam in their predetermined, calculated, appointed time according to the Christian calendar. But on the contrary, you, the people, take the sovereignty. Not you, the priest, take the sovereignty. So the great change is the change of the calendar from a solar calendar into a lunar calendar. The people who were deprived of the solar calendar were this group, a Kohanim named Sadok of Kohan. They continue to write, and continue to write, and continue, hundreds of documents in which all of them, we are told that 364 days in a year. And they repeat it, and repeat it, and repeat it all the time. 364 days in a year. Rosh Hashanah is on Wednesday. They don't call it Rosh Hashanah. They call it Yom Zikaron. Yom HaShavuot is on Sunday. Omer is on Sunday. They say it time and again. They're never too tired to say it. And they say that those who think differently are sinners, are think different. But I wanted to be very, very clear. There are two stages here. Those who made the decision to accept the change, the lunar calendar, were first the Hashmoneans who were imposed by the Seleucians to impose a lunar calendar. If you read Daniel carefully, Daniel 7 and Daniel 11, you would find the verses where he describes Antiochus who is changing the Moadim, that's in the Aramaic part. However, then it takes place in the 2nd century before the Common Era. The Antiochian imposition of the lunar calendar, to which the Hashmoneans have to agree because they are appointed kings by the Hashmoneans. Shimon is appointed by Alexander Balak. Jonathan is appointed by Antiochus Epiphanes. So they cannot fight against it. They are accepting it because that's the rule of the game. However, those who accept it, the lunar calendar, are called Bnei Choshech, while those who accept the solar calendar are called Bnei Or. 200 years later, we are jumping to the date of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva may not know all of it. He may forget all of it. He may not realize it, that it was the Antiochian lunar calendar that was important. He chooses, with others, to have a lunar calendar because this is a democratic calendar, because he is interested in deposing the priestly hegemony who held to the solar calendar. Oh, definitely. But who is rebelling against it? The Tzedakim, the Bnei Tzedok. In numerous places in the Mishnah, in Mishnah Menachot, Mishnah Yadayim, we have those discussions. Kovrano Alechem Tzedokim. What is the big deal about the Omer? Why did David say that you should withdraw the Omer right in the Mosaecha? And with a big deal, you know, with a big fuss and all that. Because the Bnei Tzedok says that Omer is always in the 26th of the first month, Mimo Horata Shabbat, while the sages says, oh no, it is in Mosaei Chag, not Mimo Horata Shabbat. Why there is a discussion about the 15th of the third month? What is the only holiday that there is no Mishnah for? Shavuot. We have no Mishnah for Shavuot. Because Shavuot is the holiday that the sages change it is day. The day of Chag Shavuot, according to the Bible, was 15 of the third month in the biblical recension that we found in Qumran. In our Bible recension, which was edited by the sages, there is no date and day for Chag HaShavuot. We are told it's only Bachodesh HaShlishi. Now, there is a dispute.
I think the Chagah would be cut out.
Oh, definitely. They would only on this issue of the calendar. They don't have it. They change a little bit of
formula.
Yes. Now, Mordechai Broiler, who is a very distinguished biblical scholar, suggests, with regardless to all what I was talking about, regardless to Qumran or anything, he says that there is no doubt in his book, Pirkei Mo'adot, in the section of Chag HaShavuot, which all of you are advised to read, he says that there is no doubt that according to the biblical recension, it should have been the 15th of the third month, and he brings evidence out of biblical criticism. Nothing to do with mysticism, with Qumran, nothing. Only within the biblical study, Mordechai Broiler, Pirkei Mo'adot, the section on Shavuot, he claims that there is no doubt that this is the correct date of Chag HaShavuot. However, now we have to realize that although the text was sacred, there were editorial decisions that were done. The sages, we are told in the Mishnah and in the Gemara, were debating whether Ezekiel should be included in the corpus, in the Maharal Shabbat Yudgimel, whether Shir HaShirim should be incorporated in the corpus, and we're also told that one should not expound in Maaseh Merkavah, Maaseh Bereshit, and Arayot, and we will talk about it later. But those are the things that the priests are expounding. Maaseh Bereshit is exactly the 7th day of creation, and the calendar divided from, the calendar reduced from it. Maaseh Merkavah, the whole entire cosmic perception, were presented in the temple. And Arayot is derived from the word Irim. It's not Arayot insects, it means Irim, which are angels. Because it is the angels who brought the calendar, and the person who brought the calendar from heaven to earth was the person who was taken from earth to heaven. Who was that? Hanok. Hanok is the hero of the solar calendar, and he is the person who was deleted from the Mishnah. There is no Hanok in the Mishnah, and I talked the day before yesterday about Hanok Matakron, who was destroyed in the four winters. We will stop now. I ask you, I remind you that do as much reading as you can. I